Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
Well, you all know how to catch wild pigs for the 4th of July, don't you? Because everyone loves their barbecue on the 4th. The 4th is the Independence Day for the American people, but, you know, who wants to talk about history when you want to get pigs in your mouth and slather them with sweet sauce and make some meat candy? Here's how you do it. Throw up a piece of fence, a side of fence, and then next to it, throw corn in there. A couple bushels of corn and the pigs will come running. They're crafty pigs, mean and dangerous. They'll kill you if they can, but just stand away, throw the corn out there, and after a month or so, put another section of fence, put another side up, and do the same thing. Corn, the pigs will come, stand back, stand away. The third side, put the third side up, but before you close off that fourth side, put a gate in that fourth side, okay? And throw a lot of corn in there, and the pigs will come in, and maybe some will look at you like, who the heck are you? And then when the pigs go in through the gate and get them used to going through the gate, more free stuff, more free corn. Pretty soon you got a lot of pigs in that pen and you're hungry for barbecue and the pigs are hungry for all their free stuff. And that's when you close the gate. And maybe some of those pigs will say, wait a minute, I used to be a free pig and I didn't want to take this free stuff that got me all trapped in the first place, but you can just say, wait your turn, pig. And you just cook them up at your leisure and enjoy your 4th of July barbecue as we celebrate the greatest country on earth, a free people. We used to be dangerous, and we've been taught to get the free stuff, just like those wild pigs. A late friend of mine, the famous alderman from the 34th Ward, the corrupt 34th Ward of Chicago, Lemuel Austin, used to say, and he used to love saying it, pigs get fat, but hogs get slaughtered.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power, and it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
So the title of this one should be Biden's debate disaster, Democrats panic, and there's no better people to talk about this than Charles Lipson, professor emeritus, University of Chicago, my friend, our friend, and prolific writer who's written a piece on it for The Spectator, and Jeff Carlin, WGN radio producer, and my friend, an expert on debate tactics.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm going to blame you for giving Joe Biden these tactics.
Yes, that was me. I told him to wait until he was almost in his 80s to run for president, and then he'd be 81 on the second time around, and he'd be right there, the sweet spot for his cognitive abilities. Yes, that was me.
So who's to blame? The Democrats can't blame themselves. They've flashed attack signals for China, Iran. Who am I forgetting? The Palestinian terrorists, Putin, North Korea. Will they blame themselves for installing this blithering idiot in the White House over Jeff Carlin and my objections 4 years ago?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I blame Debbie Wasserman Schultz in them fixing it for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Here's one for Professor Lipson. I blame, and I think I shall blame, the Democrats, the Obama-Clinton people, for getting rid of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
And the Democrats did not have a cleansing breath. You know, right. It would have been disastrous for them, but they would have at least cleaned out their party. And what we go.
You're right. They gave Hillary the notes. I mean, that whole thing. I mean, Joe Biden was vice president, right? And then why didn't he run for president afterwards? Because it was Hillary Clinton's time. Like they decided that.
No,
we saw it happen, but that's what they did. And they are reaping the benefits of that mistake now.
That's exactly right. That was Obama's decision, and I believe it was Obama's decision, although we don't have this completely nailed down, that Kamala Harris should be the vice presidential candidate for Joe Biden, and he had better options, including Val Demings, if he wanted a black woman who was a representative and a former police chief in Orlando, Florida. But they are stuck now. And I've listened to some very senior Democrats with a lot of experience who really don't see any way out of this. That is, they don't see a way to drop Joe Biden, even if Joe Biden were to want to get out and he would have to be forced out. But even if he dropped out voluntarily, their problem is that nobody wants to see Kamala Harris elected. Even Democrats don't want it. And if they force her out, they've got a real problem because they've played identity politics for decade after decade. And if they end up dropping a black woman from the ticket, they really have a problem. Even if they were to pick a black man, let's say Cory Booker, for their number two spot, it would hurt one of their key constituencies, which is black women, and
it's the only one they've got left.
Yeah, they would begin to think, well, hey, we're only fit for the number two job. It was like years ago when broadcast networks finally decided, long after they should have, that they needed to have some black anchors, and you could tell on a local station if it was the weekend, because there was a black anchor on.
Right.
Yeah. And Charles, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but isn't the DNC stuck too, in the sense that, you know, they've pushed a lot of their primaries up to be competitive or whatever? And so they've got names already on ballots. I mean, Biden's name is on a ballot in a lot of states. How do you get around that? I mean, you can't pull them both off. So it's got to be her if he's going to go away.
Well, He's got all the delegates pledged for a victory on the first ballot.
Right.
The only way that he doesn't win is if he releases them. And I don't know the legal status of doing that. Each state would have different laws.
Right.
About whether he could say, I direct you to vote for whoever you want. You're released from me. But they may be directed by the state law of, you know, whatever state it is. That they must vote for whoever the primary put in place. Now, Biden could then say, if he were nominated, I refuse to accept the nomination. But the problem is, besides Kamala being number two in line, that there's nobody to say, well, it's not going to be Mr. X, it's going to be Ms. Y, or vice versa. There's nobody to pick between Gavin Newsom and Governor Pritzker and Whitmer and all the other people who would like to have the nomination. So it would be a bloody mess at the convention. The only person who might come in and sort of sweep the floor would be Michelle Obama. But Michelle Obama is, like I used to think, every Bears fan, every Chicago Bears fan, thought that the best person on the team had to be the backup quarterback, right? Because had to be better than what was in there right now.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, now, okay, Michelle aside, because I don't know if she really wants to work.
And I agree.
Besides, she's making millions living in a mansion at sea level, working for Netflix and so forth. But it would be delicious in terms of identity politics if Charles Lipson could go back in time and teach a course on how the Democrats got rid of the black female Democrat vice president in favor of a Jewish Democrat who supports Israel. I wonder how that would work out.
Oh, I didn't even think of that, John.
I got that from our friend Dan Proft, because I was on with him Friday after the debate, thinking about coming on here. And I was thinking, and all the nonsense that was being spewed at us, conspiracy theories and so on, and Charles and you have laid it out simply. It's really not going to happen. Yeah. Barack Obama started this by not letting democracy take its course and stabbing Bernie Sanders in the back. And now the Democrats reap what they sow, no?
I think that's right. I think that there's something very big going on here in both parties. And let me see if I can lay that out. Mm-hmm. Trump has fundamentally transformed the Republican Party, not only because of his overwhelming personality, for better or for worse, but rather he's turned it away from the George H.W. Bush. It's a country club party that favors corporate executives and all the rest. And you can see that Joe Biden is still running against that party, right? It doesn't exist anymore. The party that Trump has created is essentially a right-wing populist party. The people who you would think of as a Harry Truman Democrat, they work in a factory or they're on the loading dock or whatever. Right. They're all Republicans now.
Right.
But conversely, you know, the old joke about WTTW, Winnetka talks to Wilmette.
Isn't that the call letters? I thought
yes, WTTW, Winnetka talks to Wilmette. And, but that's now the core of the Democratic coalition, educated professionals and transfer payments to poor people, plus identity politics. And it's that combination that has kind of trapped them in their current situation. That and the fact that there's no more money to spend. And that the policies aren't working. Name a Democratic city that is well run.
How about one that you can actually walk in without having to carry some sort of projectile shooting device in your pocket?
Well, you can walk in Austin, but then again, everybody there is armed.
Right.
But the fact is, this is a failed governing model. And it's also the case. So there's this transformation of both parties. Mm-hmm. And I think what you saw in the defeat of Fire Marshal Jamal Bowman is that the Democrats who've gone along with the squad have painted themselves into a very difficult corner where they've alienated a lot of the electorate. They played ideological politics. They played guilt politics. They played identity politics.
And anti-Semitism. I'm sorry, but to me, that's what their calling card has been. they accuse others of anti-Semitic behavior, and at the same time, they're the first ones pouncing on any Jew they could find to threaten them. I mean, that's been the most telling and unfortunate aspect of all this to me.
I wouldn't go that far. Okay. What I would say is that there is an element on the far left of the Democratic Party that is within the party. There are far right people, the old Ku Klux Klan types, who are anti-Semitic, but they're not within the Republican Party. But the far left squad people are anti-Semitic. But what's really been the problem, I think, beyond that, and anti-Semitism on many of these issues is a canary in the coal mine, is that the law-breaking has been so pervasive since the George Floyd summer. And Democrats who are the George Soros Democrats, right, in the prosecutor's office, look at what they've done in New York. They let the people who occupy these buildings at Columbia, they've let them all walk scot-free while they look for Donald Trump two misdemeanors on which the statute of limitations had run out. And they managed to gin those up into a felony and convict him. And people can just see the fundamental unfairness, and they can see chaos in the streets. And that's why the open southern border resonates so much. First of all, people can see it on the streets. In Chicago, you can see these people begging on every street. This used to not be the case. There used to be poor people, many of them black, who would beg. But now you see these vast numbers of
entire families,
immigrants. Right. And that is also tied to crime. People in their mind tie it to crime. And it is also splitting the Democratic coalition because these new immigrants are competing with African Americans, both for government resources and for some kinds of jobs.
So it looks like there's a book in here. Maybe the title would be After Biden and the Democrats Were Ready to Vote for Caesar.
Boy, I hope not. I hope not. Let me just say that if it ends up being Trump against Kamala Harris, it would be Caesar versus Caesar salad.
There it is. I
think there's a great book here, and I'm sure people will look at it.
Well, I just think that the overwhelming feeling in a lot of the electorate is that they don't like the choices we have.
Right.
And that
one thing we can all agree on.
Right. I mean, I think that it's hard to name somebody who would be really a very appealing choice on the Democratic side, maybe Whitmer, but on the Republican side, I think Governor Glenn Youngkin from Virginia would win overwhelmingly. Let me change subjects just slightly.
Yeah,
I think that in all the decisions that have come out about from the Supreme Court, I think that the decision called Chevron deference is absolutely huge. And I want to explain what it means and why I think it's huge.
Give us this historical context too, please.
We used to think, we were taught in high school civics, that Congress passes a law and the law basically tells us what you can and cannot do and what the penalties are if you do what you can't do. And that's the rules. That's not the kind of laws that Congress passes these days, and it's not what Congress does. Congress passes laws that sometimes say over 2,000 times in a single law, the Secretary of Commerce or the Secretary of Health and Human Services or whoever it is shall make a determination to do X, Y, or Z. So in other words, they're delegating what should be legislative powers. They don't have the right to do that. But what happens is that the laws that they pass are filled with so many gaps that they're handing power over to the bureaucracies. What does that leave Congress doing? It leaves Congress basically with an oversight of the bureaucracy's role rather than a legislative role. And the Supreme Court some years ago, believe it or not, under Antonin Scalia, of all people, said, look, when there is ambiguity in the law, we're going to defer to the experts in the bureaucracy. And that was called the Chevron decision, or sometimes Chevron deference. They named these after one of the litigants in the case where it was decided. And what the Supreme Court just released on Friday was that is not constitutionally proper. And as
the reasons,
the reasons are Congress can't delegate its legislative power, and these unelected bureaucrats don't have that power. And the court said, in effect, we can determine what the law is if it's ambiguous. So what would happen is, let me give you a concrete case. There was a law that said that as part of the environment, you can regulate what are called the waters of the United States, which had to do with navigable rivers. And bureaucracies try to expand their power. And so a guy on some arid upland, I believe in Montana, I may have the state wrong, dug a little pond for his cows to drink water. And the EPA or some other related organization fined him $70,000 a day.
Day, yeah.
For violating the Waters of the United States Act. And he said, look, this water doesn't flow into anything. But they said essentially all waters eventually make it into a navigable river. And had this man not been defended by a conservative pro bono legal organization, he would have had to give in, because who can pay $70,000 a day besides Elon Musk? But they overturned that. And that's what you're going to see is that if Congress may decide, hey, we still want to abdicate our responsibilities, we'll just let the courts decide all these things. But that's not good either. We need elected representatives to take responsibility, belly up to the bar, and say, what's the limits of a navigable river in a way that tells the bureaucrats, you can regulate this, you can't regulate that. There are going to be details that you're going to hand off, but you can't hand off big substantive decisions. And that's exactly what the court decided. And that goes to the heart, not only of the administrative state, but of the whole Democratic Party ethos since Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
The rise of the experts, rise of the experts, yeah.
They've been hard hit since COVID, right? Because experts haven't looked very good.
No.
By the way, I thought that one of the most effective lines that Trump had in the debate, I thought Trump made a number of mistakes in the debate. When the other guy's hurting himself, stay out of the way and don't emphasize what many voters think is your worst tendencies, which is to go over the top. But I thought that when he said, after listing really big mistakes, who got fired?
Right. That was good.
Right.
It was just devastating.
And he also gave good answers on abortion. He talked about abortion as what is ideally going back to the state so that people could, make their own determination in terms of supporting the republic, because the Democrats say they support democracy and really don't, but conservatives do. And the third thing that he did, I thought that was devastating, was when I think it was when Joe Biden said that we had defeated Medicare. and Trump said, I don't think he knows what he just said.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
Oh.
And he said, I think at one point that we got unemployment down from 50%.
I think he said 15%. 15.15.
Oh, yeah,
that was wrong. Was over.
Yeah, was that ludicrous. Was wrong, but you can't understand a guy who's mumbling.
Right.
But I think the right way to play that is, it's just sad. Don't dance on that grave. Just say it's sad to see somebody in this kind of situation. But you wouldn't let this guy drive your kids to McDonald's for a Happy Meal.
You wouldn't hire him to work at McDonald's, for God's sake. Well, not that.
That's right.
There's hot oil.
But
there's hot oil around there.
I think that Trump, on the abortion issue, let me touch that third rail.
Uh-huh.
I think Republicans who are now saying that they're not disadvantaged by the abortion issue are in dreamland, because although the issue ranks relatively low when you ask people what are the most important issues for you, for people who think it's the most important issue, it is the single most important issue. They will vote on that issue, and Trump's big area where he's losing, where he's way behind Biden, is among women, and especially among educated women. So I think it's a bigger deal than people say. I think that what Trump should have said, and would have been consistent with what he actually believes, is whether you like the Supreme Court decision or not, it has been turned back to the states, and therefore it's a Democratic decision. If Joe Biden is elected, he's not going to be able to reverse that decision. There's just no way that he's going to be able to reinstate Roe. So the real issue is what kind of laws states will pass. And I can tell you, as president, I will advocate for, let's say, a 15-week or a 22-week law in each state. I'm not going to try to overturn the rule. I'm not going to try to say that there has to be a national law, but I am going to state that I'm going to use my power, which is quite influential, to try to pick a kind of reasonable number that we can, if not all agree on, at least kind of coalesce around. And I think he could have made some headway there, because I don't think he would have lost the evangelical vote on that. But I think he would have gained some votes on that.
I think that would have gone against his brand, and I don't think he needed to do that.
Say more about that, Jeff.
Well, he is the guy who says, you know, who takes it to the extreme sometimes, where we'll, you know, say, well, that maybe we need to go this far, not necessarily saying that that's the way it is, but he leaves himself open. You know, he's a guy who is not ever really hard down on one statement, and drilling down too deep into details on something like that does risk people, because there are plenty of people in this country who do feel that, you know, if as soon as a heartbeat is discovered, that's a child, and that's that child. There are lots of those people, especially if you're on social media. And so I think they might be, not that they won't vote for him, because I don't think that's going to happen, but they might just be bothered by it, and it would tamp down their ability as a grassroots to further their friends or talk about, you know, and he doesn't need that. He's got it. I mean, I think the abortion thing, and even with the Supreme Court, you know, coming out and saying, oh, you know, emergency abortions, you know, we got to have some sort, you know, that standing up for that law, I think signals enough to be, look, even the Supreme Court isn't going to go that crazy, you know, and I think that's the last guard. I think he just needs to keep being himself, because and the tamped down, you know, reserved adult in the room kind of self that he's done a couple of times throughout these different campaigns. But this debate was the first time I really saw him as a guy who could control himself, which in my mind has always been my worry. You know, he's a guy who acts on impulse, you know, just and throughout his history. That's just how he is. And
yeah, he was in control this time.
Yeah.
I'm going to differ with you guys a little bit, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I thought that he was in control compared to previous performances.
Sure.
But he was not in control according to any normal definition of that. No. Especially in the second half of the debate. If he had tamped it down a little, I thought that there was just too much hyperbole. Let Joe Biden say, come on, man. Everything you said was a lie.
The idea.
The very idea. And by the way, I thought that Joe Biden.
I must interrupt just to give a public service announcement. We are speaking with Charles Lipson, professor emeritus, the University of Chicago, and the author of the aptly titled After the Debate, The Deluge: Every Sentient Democrat Should Be in Full-Scale Panic in the Spectator. Charles, you wrote this piece in the middle of the night, apparently, hours after the debate. That was a rough night for you, sir.
It was even rougher. I wrote two pieces.
Oh.
The first piece said, here's my assessment of the debate. Let me just say to the to listeners, when the debate is over, I cut off the TV. I don't want to hear what anybody else says. Mm-hmm. I want to make my own decision. So my assessment of the debate, which began with there was a lot of hyperbole on both sides, I thought that the for all the prior criticism of Tapper and Dana Bash before the debate, I thought that they were very professional. And then I said, look, Joe Biden is just clearly in cognitive and physical decline, and it's unavoidable. And you can just see it. This is a naked emperor problem. And so that was my first column. And then my second column, after moi, the deluge, was essentially a what now for the Democrats. And that laid out what we talked about in the first part of this podcast, which is that the Democrats are in an insoluble situation. They can't get rid of Joe Biden, and even if they could, they have the Kamala problem as number two, and if they get rid of her, although they could come up with a more appealing candidate, that would be virtually anybody on the subway. They would lose key constituency that they built up over 50 years since the mid-60s, which is a black women's vote. And I just think that they're, as we say in the South, they're between the dog and the hydrant.
So what are they, the question is, then they have, in order to, I guess, rehabilitate Biden, they must cast Trump as some psychotic, I don't know, demon.
Well, they've had, first of all, they have to hide Biden.
Yeah.
And, or at the very least, put him out in front of a small crowd with a teleprompter, which is what they did on Friday. And he made a reasonably good speech, he sort of, everything is one note. He sort of yells everything, screaming Biden. But Trump is an entertainer, and Trump will go out and talk in front of these crowds. I think Trump needs to tamp it down. But the Democrats will be called out for hiding Biden. And there, I mean, the fact, I looked at the New York Times front page.
Oh, God. Yes, Charles. You sent this to us before we started recording, yes. And it's brilliant.
Tell people what it is.
Oh, I mean, it's just, if you thought the New York Times was a legitimate newspaper before, this might change your mind. The morning after the debate, the morning after, probably one of the most prolifically watched and cringed about debates in U.S. history, or probably history of any people, really.
Enjoyed. I almost went back to smoking cigars because I wanted to put my feet up.
Maybe after the fact, John.
Yeah.
You had to be cringy watching it. But anyway, not a single mention on the front page of a debate. The word debate does not appear anywhere. And it's not
there
like
there must
a
be
late
20
debate.
Stories. There must well, be 20 stories.
The NHL draft got higher billing than a debate.
Like, and then they figured out later in the day, they figured out Biden should drop out.
Right, exactly.
And at that point, every New York Times columnist wrote an op-ed piece, wrote a column that said, yeah, Biden should drop out. Now they'll have columns. But once they figure out, so here's my view. Once they figure out that they can't get rid of him, then they'll go back to that old front page.
What do they do? What do they and the rest of America, at least the American left, do? The ones who are consumers of MSNBC, because after the debate, I had to get up at 3 a.m, but I didn't have to write. So I turned off Fox News because I can't stand that station. And I went over to listen to the crying of MSNBC and CNN.
I did the same thing. I watch a lot of CNN during the day because I think that gives me a good sense of what the spin is. It's really hard for me to watch MSNBC, but I did it in this time.
So what do they do about Joe Scarborough, Morning Joe, who is like, he literally said, F you. It literally told his audience, F you. Biden is at the top of his game. He sounded like a fight promoter, like our old friend Benny Bentley. You know, he looks like a million. He's a champ. He can do. I mean, this is the media that serves the left. What do they do now?
I can tell you what they do, because I was first of all, I was at a meeting that maybe had 40 or 50 people who are well-informed, highly educated Democrats who are pretty plugged in. They do media, they do reporting, they do lobbying. Some do local politics, local mayors or ward committee men or whatever. First thing is they were in panic. And the second thing I would say is, but what about Trump? And so it was always going to be a negative campaign, but I think they have to turn the negatives on Trump up to 11. That's their only option. Don't vote for Biden. Vote against Trump. The problem with that is that, although I think that is their best strategy, probably, it actually discourages turnout. It just won't get people to the polls. And, I mean, the Democrats have a better, get out the vote machine than the Republicans, although the Republicans have been working on it. And they certainly have a better mail-in vote and all of that. I'm not talking about the people who think it's all fraud and so forth. I'm just saying that the legitimate get out the vote stuff that the Democrats have has been better. Republicans are improving. I think that their only real strategy now is to say Trump is a danger to democracy. This will be the last election you'll ever vote in. He will seize the government. All he really wants to do, it's all going to be January 6th, not because people particularly remember the things on January 6th, except what they remember is that it looked like some crazy people tried to prevent the Congress from certifying the election. And at the very least, Trump did not try to stop those people from doing that. It's probably too much to say he encouraged them. He encouraged them to come to Washington for sure. But and then as they were doing that in the Capitol, he sort of sat silent for about 3 hours. As soon as he told them to leave, they left. But I think that everything has to go completely negative on the Democratic side and say Trump is a true danger to the democracy. And Trump's best response to that is to tamp down anything that would give them another reason to distort what he is saying.
Yeah, you know, Charles, after that debate, I don't think Trump needs, I think he needs to just keep on keeping on. I think the right. Dems are in such big tailspin, and that negative stuff's not going to pull anybody away from him who wasn't already voting. I don't think anybody who came out of Thursday being like, well, I'm glad I'm voting for Trump is now going to be turned on that. I think, you know, we're looking at obviously the independents and kind of that swing. I think they move away from Biden because he looks senile and they don't right. trust him. And I feel they just don't vote. I mean, they're just going to depress the vote, which is going to hurt Biden.
Yes. I agree with that. And I would say that you're also going to get more what used to be called shy Trump voters. Mm-hmm. They're going to be women in Winnetka who are going to end up voting for Trump, but sure. not saying that they will.
So sure. if you're the Republican media people, the Republican corporate media that will push out commercials and so forth, radio spots, what would they be? What will their themes be? How will they focus? What will they?
They'll just use Biden's own words and, you know, his inability to, and much like the Democrats do with Trump when he rambles and says incoherent. I mean, how many videos of the like that hit the internet every day? I think that'll just, they're going to, the Republicans now really have, I mean, they have ace material to make those things out of now. And if Biden keeps on going, I mean, the way he's been going, it's just going to look terrible. I mean, that video, I mean, how fast did that video of Jill Biden patting him on the head after he answered every question and that boy. Thing became, was rifting through the internet and fire.
I agree with Jeff and would add one more thing. Okay. You're going to see a lot of pictures of cackling Kamala.
Oh yeah.
yeah.
Because I think that the Republicans' basic positive message is, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Right. I think their negative message is, as bad as you think Joe Biden is, does anybody think he can make it through 4 years? And then you're going to see a picture of Miss get to the root causes in Central America of immigration. And you're going to see a lot of stuff about violence. And by the way, these two conventions pose real risks, I think, more for the Democrats than for the Republicans. But in general, they pose risks not because people who will be rioting in the streets are Democrats, but rather because the party in power pays a price when there's disorder.
Well, I think it's a problem for the Republicans in Milwaukee because, as a conservative, the last place I would eat in is Milwaukee during the convention in a restaurant. No way. Oh, yeah. I'd bring apples and cheese and live off that and maybe some wine.
I went to every year the Republicans, the Tories in England right. have an annual convention, and I went to one when I was living in England as a visiting professor at London School of Economics for a year. It was the last year Thatcher was in power, and they met actually in a seaside resort where the last time they had met there 4 or 5 years ago, there had been a bomb trying to kill Thatcher. Wow. And I went to a restaurant, John and Jeff, and looked over at the next table, and the entire cabinet was eating there. I never have felt more endangered, but I did think of a Margaret Thatcher joke as they were dining. which is they go to Margaret Thatcher. She wasn't there, but they go to Margaret Thatcher and say, what do you want, Madam Prime Minister? What do you want for your main course? And she says, steak. And then they say, what about vegetables? And she said, they'll take steak too.
Charles, that's a great, great joke. And thank you. Thanks so much. And thanks so much for writing.
Yes.
And for doing all your good work.
Your deep thoughts are always always helpful.
I'm the Jack Handy of
exactly. Really. Taking big rocks and breaking them into smaller rocks for the rest of us to understand.
Because that way we can get our teeth, our mouths around those small rocks.
Exactly.
Charles. Okay, John, you come from a great Greek heritage. Who put rocks in his mouth to become a better speaker?
I was thinking about him the other day as Biden was babbling and bibbling, but you know what? He did not have the spears hanging down from the ceilings to stab him when he twitched. And this was none other than one of the great orators of all time. And even though we don't have tape, Demosthenes.
That's right. Demosthenes. And, I've been looking for some of Demosthenes' speeches. I was just reading Demosthenes' speech number 19 this week. So you are right. It is a great heritage, and Biden put the rocks in his mouth, but he forgot to take them out.
I think the staffers put the rocks in them. The fact that the thing that's upsetting and kind of strange. None of the staffers who prepared him for that are going to lose their jobs. And that
not until January.
January, right.
Good to talk to you guys.
Thanks, Charles. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Charles.
Bye to you both. It's such a pleasure. I really enjoy these chats. Yeah, they're real chats. They really are.
We're going to have one coming up that you're going to enjoy.
Yeah.
I found some old tapes. Mm-hmm. That my father, my late father, talked into, who was interviewed for about three or four hours, and Jeff and I found them. We're going to put them on the, you know, about how he survived the war and the communists and all that. Yeah,
I tell the story of your father's was it a mule
Truman
or
Truman the mule? Yeah,
yeah, Truman the mule. Yeah.
I think it's a great story. People don't know what the Marshall Plan is anymore, except us old guys. But they need to understand that when you're in the shape that a country like Greece was in after the war, it doesn't do any good to just send them money. They need stuff.
Yeah, and they don't need speeches. They need food.
Right. Good to talk to you guys.
Thanks, see you, Charles.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Be well. For Charles Lipson, Professor Charles Lipson, writer extraordinaire, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, and for Jeff Carlin, Executive Producer, WGN Radio, maker of pies, friend of cats, future physics teacher, and husband to the lovely Christine. Hi, Christine. And for me, John Cass, John Cass News, subscribe today where you always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. Happy 4th of July, everybody. Happy Independence Day, America. And we'll talk to you next time on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.